It's Thursday. You're tuned to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR and on WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you're along here today. We have an interesting show. We've got Paula Cunningham and Charlie Creamer of the L3 Public School Academy here in Lansing coming up. They apparently had their contract revoked to operate their school yesterday, so they will explain the road ahead and what is coming up. And we've also got live music in the studio here today. It is Mighty Ook, well, Ook Day. I'm told that the correct pronunciation is actually ukulele, but it's actually Mighty Ook Day here, and we've got some Ook players. Ben Hassinger among them, Chris Hamilton and Andy Wilson, who are going to be joining us here today. They're all waving at the microphone dutifully, so there they are. And we're going to be hearing some ukulele music here throughout the show today. We hope you can stick around for that. Lots coming up here on Current State. You can reach us anytime at currentstate@wkar.org. But first this morning, Michigan spends $2 billion annually on its prison system. That's slightly more than one-fifth of the state's general fund, according to a 2012 House Fiscal Agency report. In order to whittle down the size of the prison system's financial burden, Michigan lawmakers have been looking at private companies to provide services. Earlier this month, state officials opted to contract with Aramark, a Pennsylvania-based company, to provide food services for the 43,000 people incarcerated here in Michigan. Officials say the contract could save the state $16 million. But some say Aramark's track record in other states is spotty at best. And during its lame duck session last December, Michigan lawmakers passed legislation that would pave the way for more privatization of prison services and even entire prisons. But critics say state efforts to save money through privatization of prisons are fraught with examples across the country of dubious budget savings, dangerously inadequate services, and moral conundrums. Here to talk about some of these apparent red flags is Natalie Holbrook, Program Director of the Michigan Criminal Justice Program for the American Friends Service Committee. Hi, Natalie.
Hi.
And joining us by phone from Austin, Texas, Bob Leibel, Executive Director of Grassroots Leadership. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Natalie, start off here and tell us first about this new contract with Aramark to provide food for Michigan's prison inmates. Tell us about this.
So the Department of Corrections has a $2 billion budget, as you pointed out, and they've been making efforts to cut that budget. And so one of the pushes from the legislature has been to privatize food services because they think that savings can be made by privatizing food services. And obviously with the request for proposals and the potential contract hanging out there right now, Aramark has promised savings of nearly 20% in food services. And so we're concerned because Aramark does not have a good track record across the country. They make cost savings through lower wages for service for their workers, and they, I think, are going to be paying less per day for meals when we already are paying on average about $2 per day for the three meals provided for prisoners in our Department of Corrections. So if you can imagine the quality of food on $2 a day for three meals already, which I have very huge concerns about, I am concerned about the quality of food that we currently are serving to prisoners. So if you're even going to pay less money for food per day, I'm concerned about that quality of food. And I'm hoping that in this discussion we can get at the nutritional value of food. We have this captive population, and we should be doing everything we can to ensure wellness of prisoners and to create healthy prisoners while they're inside. And if we're serving them sodium laden, soy-based food, it's very problematic and heavily processed food, and I think that's what we are serving. The other problem with Aramark, and I'm concerned about locally sourced food, where it might be coming from with the Aramark contract, and none of us have seen the contract. It's still floating in Department of Management, Technology, and Budget, and with the Michigan Department of Corrections. So I'm concerned on multiple levels. There's also this issue of oversight and accountability. You have a Department of Corrections that's a state agency, and we, as the public, as taxpayers, should have open access to information around budgetary issues and what's going on in our prisons. And when you add a private corporation into the mix, you add layers of bureaucracy, and it becomes more difficult to have oversight and accountability.
Go a little bit deeper, though, into why people should care so much about what. Why is it so important what incarcerated people who are in jail on a jailable crime, why is what they eat really, should that be such a big concern?
Well, I think there's multiple concerns. We have a $429 million four-year contract with Corizon Healthcare Services, and we also pay more for nurses. We have to provide health care for people in prison. So we should be concerned about prisoners' health and well-being. Also, a large chunk of people are coming back to our community, so we should be treating them with dignity and respect while they're there. And the other issue with food is, and historically, if you go back in time and look at what precipitated disturbances in prisons across the country, in the 70s and the 80s, food was always an issue. Prisoners need to be treated with dignity and respect, and they need to be treated humanely, but we don't want to be serving them bad quality food, skimping on food, and then potentially adding to disturbances within the prisons.
There was a food riot not too long ago, I want to say in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
And Aramark held that contract.
And Aramark held that contract. And you're also asserting that that there is a health price to pay because of the poor nutritional quality. People are fed substandard food in prisons and they end up seeing a doctor more often as a result?
It could potentially happen. We also have a large lifer population. People are growing old inside. If we serve them poor quality of food, and they also may come to prison with chronic health issues to begin with, or they may develop chronic health issues while they're there, in the long term, their health care costs are going to skyrocket. I mean, I think that while we have people inside, we should be teaching wellness and nutrition, we should be teaching healthy living, and we should be providing food that's healthy. The other place that people have access to food in prisons is the commissary. And when I look at the commissary list, it's oftentimes candy that's available, ramen noodles, which have a lot of sodium in them. There's sausages and tortilla chips and canned food and processed food. And so the access that people have to quality, fresh food is very limited. And I think some prisoners want healthy food. Some prisoners may need to be taught to desire healthy food. Already some prisoners want healthy food. So I think that if they were offered more healthy food, more fresh options, then things would be better inside.
Let's bring Bob Seibel into this discussion. Bob, last December, the Michigan legislature passed a bill that would allow the Department of Corrections to competitively bid for operations and services as long as it results in at least 10% savings. Some versions of the legislation even specifically mentioned the Baldwin Youth Correctional Facility. That's a private prison here in Michigan that sat vacant since 2005. Bob, give us some history on Baldwin. What's happened there?
Sure. So, you know, I think that this bill, was drafted without looking at the history of this facility, or perhaps drafted under the sort of influence of private prison lobbyists. These are corporations that have more than $1 billion in annual revenue and turn around and spend a substantial portion of that in lobbying and campaign contributions to ensure that their bottom lines are met. And in Michigan, you all have a very troubled history with the corporation that operates the Baldwin facility. This was the Michigan Youth Correctional Facility that was originally opened in 1999 for youth who had been sentenced as adults. But very quickly, that facility experienced major problems. It was operated by the company called Wackenhut Corrections Corporation, which later became the GEO Group, the second largest private prison corporation in the United States. The Grand Rapids Press did a report on this and found that the prison had more violence than its state-run counterparts. State lawmakers looked into it. There was a series of hearings. They found that there were allegations that 95% of the guards working at the prison had no previous corrections experience, and that the facility had 33 attempted suicides in the first half of 2000 alone.
What does GEO Group do exactly, though? Do they run the whole operation or just parts of the operation or what?
Yeah, so GEO Group and its sort of counterpart Corrections Corporation of America are for-profit prison corporations that operate prisons in states and for the federal government across the United States. So these are companies that have turned mass incarceration into a really big business. These are companies that have annual revenues of more than $3 billion combined. They're companies that have become big players when it comes to shaping criminal justice and immigration policy. They spend millions of dollars lobbying and on campaign contributions.
But to both of you, a question. What is the public to make of the potential savings involved in privatization? There are some prisons, I'm led to believe, in other states that do seem to be working okay with some degree of privatization. And I'm sure it varies. But can you candidly give us a sense of how much money prisons with privatized services might be able to save taxpayers? Natalie?
I think in the long run, the question is a different question. We need to be working to decarcerate our system, get less people in the system, only hold people in the system who we really truly think are dangerous, and we can reduce costs that way. So I don't think that privatization is the answer to cost savings. I think there are other mechanisms for cost savings.
How many people incarcerated in Michigan right now?
44,000 people.
No, but how many of them don't really need to be in prison? Do you know?
I would say there's a good 12,000 people. That is based on people who might be past their earliest release date, drug crimes that people are going to prison for. We send people to prison for longer lengths of stay than other states. So I think that we really, and I just threw that number out there, but I do think it's a legitimate number. I think that we have to enact presumptive parole in this state, where people are actually paroled at their earliest release date if they've demonstrated good institutional conduct and have not demonstrated bad institutional conduct, and we can get more people out of the system and have larger cost savings. I think that privatization opens us up for litigation that could cost us a heck of a lot of money down the road. It also opens us up for poor quality in our system. And I think that we should have... While I hate that we have professionalized correctional positions and staff, because prisons have just we have mass incarceration in this country, and it's really problematic that we are relying on prisons for employment in some of our communities, and that bothers me. I think that the people, while they are there, should be professional. They should be paid a decent wage, a living wage, and they should not be paid skimpy wages. And I think that privatization leads to staff who are paid skimpy wages.
Let's get Bob Leibel in here. Where's the line as far as you're concerned, Bob? How do we know when we've just cut too much from our prison system?
Well, I mean, I think when it comes to privatization, though, the biggest cost savings for private prison corporations is in staffing, right? I mean, that they simply pay people less and pay them less in terms of benefits as well. And the result of that is that you have a much higher turnover rate than you do in the public sector. A state study here in Texas found that private prisons in Texas in 2009, I believe, had a 90% annual staff turnover rate. Now,
okay,
Imagine running any kind of institution on a 90% annual turnover rate.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We want to thank both of our guests for joining us here today on an important discussion. Natalie Holbrook is the program director of the Michigan Criminal Justice Program for the American Friends Service Committee, and Bob Leibel is executive director of Grassroots Leadership and is based in Austin, Texas. Thank you, Natalie. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's Mighty Uke Day here on Current State, and we are joined by a trio of uke players here who are going to talk to us about the ukulele and do some performing while we're at it here today. The Mighty Uke Day Trio, as they're calling themselves. Let's give a listen.
Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes a Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there, there goes a Spider-Man. In the chill of night, at the scene of a...
the mighty Uke Day Trio here on Current State. Today we'll be hearing more from the mighty Uke Day Trio, as they're calling themselves, Chris Hamilton, Andy Wilson, and Ben Hassinger, a little bit later in the program. Tonight, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra wraps up its season with a program featuring music from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet and the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 1. WKAR's Melissa Benmark caught up with conductor Timothy Muffet for a preview.
Rachmaninoff wrote 4 concerti total, and the second and the third have become kind of the war horses of the concert hall. But this first concerto, for me, is one of those early explosions of genius along the lines of the Mendelssohn Midsummer Night's Dream, where it's one of the first works out of the composer, and it's just remarkably well-conceived. It's got all the trademarks that we love from Rachmaninoff, the beautiful melodies and the sense of drama and the unfolding, and of course the incredible piano virtuosity. Far from being empty virtuosity, but it's thrilling. It's absolutely thrilling piano writing. Really heartfelt second movement. But it has all of these wonderful qualities that we love of Rachmaninoff. And then on top of that, it's a really tightly conceived piece of music, and there's not a sense of sprawl, and there's not a sense of, we're in and out in under 30 minutes, and the statements seem complete and focused and concise, and I just love this concerto. It's a great, great work.
You know, that's interesting to me that you said about a tightly edited work, because it just had never crossed my mind until this minute that, much like an author that you would read in the book, some composers will use more than they need to get the point across, and others will write very tightly, like, for instance, a Hemingway or something.
Right. And also it's a matter of that many of the musical ideas that are presented spring from other musical ideas, much in the way Beethoven operated, not in the same sense of small fragments, but there is a natural, as this piece unfolds, each section feels connected to that which preceded it. And so it's a beautifully inspired piece. I think he probably, I don't know the details, but I would guess it's one of those things that he sat down and wrote in a spurt of inspiration, and it has that sound to it.
Tell me a little bit about the soloist. I understand he's a repeat guest for us.
Well, Christopher O'Reilly, yes, was here before playing the Manuel de Falla's Nights in the Gardens of Spain, one of my favorite pieces of music for piano and orchestra. But it's not a big piano showcase. It's certainly the piano and the orchestra are very, very closely integrated in that. And so, you know, here we brought in one of the world's most highly regarded and well-known pianists, and I thought it'd be nice to bring him back and have him play a piece where he steps out in front a little bit more, as in a true concerto fashion. And this was a work that Chris suggested, this first concerto of Rachmaninoff, and I'm so glad he did. It's been a really exciting experience to get familiar with this piece and prepare it.
And then the other piece on the program is the Prokofiev selections from Romeo and Juliet. And one thing I suppose we should make clear is that this is not the Romeo and Juliet that people will hear in cartoons and advertisements and et cetera, the Tchaikovsky fantasy.
Right. This is, I think, a almost miraculous score in the complete ballet of Prokofiev. We're not doing the complete ballet. We've put together a suite that follows the basic arc of the story and includes many of the musical highlights.
You put it together yourself?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So this is something that people may not have heard, this particular assemblage.
Yeah, they probably haven't. But they'll know many of these movements if they're familiar with the composer published 3 concert suites. You know, I've taken some liberty here, and the problem for me with the suites is that they don't reflect the storyline very well. Or there are certain movements that now over the years have become audience favorites, and so why not include them, put them all together into something? But then also, I mean, more importantly for me was kind of retaining sort of the integrity of the story and having the experience of hearing this ballet suite somewhat resemble the experience of the play. But this is some of Prokofiev's most extraordinary music in terms of characterization, in terms of ambiance, atmosphere, drama. And he really very much taps into his romantic side on this, however, always retaining that clarity and focus and almost pristine quality that we associate with Prokofiev, his neoclassic side. There's a reason that it's a perennial favorite in the concert halls, and it's just always a pleasure to live in this music.
Do you have a favorite section of it?
That's difficult to say because I love it all. I do find all of the music towards the end, Romeo at Juliet's tomb, and then the death of Juliet, to be just a level of inspiration that is extraordinary. And almost as a listener, you feel almost as if you are inside Romeo's head at one point with the swirling, the his sense of being overcome with the situation and not knowing which way to turn, and I can't believe this has happened. And then the tragedy continues. But even in the end, the death of Juliet movement that brings the whole suite, that brings the ballet and the suite to a close, the way Prokofiev reflects on the story in the music and the way he deals with both the passion and the innocence and the purity in this one gesture, all in a retrospective mode, and then bringing the whole thing to a close with the utmost of simplicity and directness gets me every time.
That is conductor Timothy Muffett of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. Tonight, the LSO wraps up its season with a program featuring Prokofiev and Rachmaninoff. And that was with WKAR's Melissa Benmark. Coming up on Current State, what's the future of Lansing's L3 Public School Academy? Two of its administrators join us to discuss that, and we've also got more from the mighty Ook Day Trio here coming up on Current State. Stay with us.
Drop because I'm hungry, my heart does a tango with every little move you make. I love you like a mango, wish we could make it every day. I want you to drop, baby, drop, baby, drop. Drop all your love on me, drop, baby, drop, baby, drop. Drop because I'm hungry, my nights would be so lonely if ever you should choose to go. I live just like a zombie with very little love to show. I want you to drop, baby. Buy you a diamond ring, my friend, if it makes you feel alright. I'll give you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel alright. Cause I don't care too much for money, money can't buy me love. I'll give you all I got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money. Money can't buy me love. Can't buy me love.
That's Lansing's mighty Ook Day Trio, as they're calling themselves. ukulele trio, Chris Hamilton, Andy Wilson, and Ben Hassinger. It is the third annual Mighty Uke Day this weekend. We're going to be talking with the players and hearing more coming up in a little bit later on here in our next segment here on Current State. Thank you for joining us here on Thursday. I'm Mark Bayshore. The administrators, staff, and students at one of Lansing's newest charter schools got some bad news yesterday. The Learn, Live, Lead Academy, launched by local banking executive and former Lansing Community College president Paula Cunningham, was told its contract was being revoked. L3, as it's called, is nearing the end of its first year of operations. In a statement, Bay Mills Community College, which is the school's authorizing body, said the action is necessary because of the academy's, quote, lack of compliance with contractual requirements, unquote. Here to talk about the situation and the road ahead for the Learn, Live, Lead Academy, founder and Capital National Bank CEO Paula Cunningham. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Mark.
And L3 Board Vice Chair Charlie Creamer. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning.
We're sorry you're joining us under these circumstances, but thank you for coming in. We're eager to learn more about this situation. The statement from Bay Mills alleged a couple of contractual requirements were not adhered to. The school did not open on time last fall, and students were not tested in the fall when they say they should have been. Are you contesting either of those?
Absolutely not.
You're not. Okay. They also say public transparency issues also surfaced. That was a quote. Also true or not?
I'm not going to debate the merits of what Bay Mills said, quite frankly. We are in compliance and been in compliance with every single issue that surfaced since January of this year. The timing is the issue in terms of, and the transparency issue is when the budget actually got posted onto the website. Those types of transparency issues is what they're referring to, I believe. But I don't want to speak for them. Yes, we did have issues when we got opened our school. Yes, we did have issues with getting building permits and getting the school code. We had less than 60 days from the time that we received our contract to the time that we opened to school. So we started, we met every requirement. We met them a little late. We did not meet all the deadlines, but we met every single requirement. And the students have progressed phenomenally well.
But this transparency issue, it's about a budget being posted online.
It's just about being, that's, I believe.
I think that's what
they're referring to. That would be better probably from Shannon, but I believe that's what they're referring to.
I see Bay Mills Charter School Office issued a notice of intent to suspend back in December. When did you begin to be concerned that your contract might be revoked? Was it December? Was it then? Was it sooner than that?
Mark, we didn't have any concerns. We thought that was more of a formality because we had, as Paula said, we had come into full compliance by January, a month later after we received that.
You were in full compliance within January on the score of the testing and on what did you come into compliance in January, though?
Everything that was in their notice of intent. Every item that was in their notice of intent was compliant in January.
So it was just the late start and the testing delay that really triggered that?
That really triggered the notice of intent?
Yeah.
The notice of intent had several other issues in it, and all those issues were addressed. The building permit, the late start, the testing. The testing wasn't even in that notice.
No.
It was not in that notice.
What's been happening real recently then?
In terms of the students?
In terms of a discussion with Bay Mills.
There actually have not been any discussions with Bay Mills because we've been in full compliance. We spent the last 5 months improving the academic performance of the kids. That's where we really focused.
Well, do you feel like you've been wronged here then by having this contract taken away?
Well, we're disappointed. We're not about pointing fingers. That would take too much energy to say who's right or wrong. We could debate that all day, quite frankly. Whichever side came out victorious, that's the site that comes out victorious. We had issues, we admit that, coming out of the gate. We had some issues in terms of startup, the timing issues in terms of getting a building permit. We've met all of those issues. We're fully compliant with everything that Bay Mills told us we needed to be compliant with by January. We're focused on the kids. Where do we go from here? How do we make certain that the students who have been in that school since September 4th, continue to make the kind of progress that they've made, and what can we do to sustain that?
Is there a formal appeals process that you're going through now?
Unfortunately, there is not. That avenue is not available to us.
So your intent, as I understand it, is just to pursue another authorizer?
Absolutely. I think that's what the board has indicated they want to do, and that they have been in discussions with other potential authorizers to make certain that the contract gets picked up, and we're doing everything we can to make certain that happens.
How many other authorizers could you reach out to for this?
Well, they're every,
Central Michigan?
Every college and university and Lansing School District and Lansing Educational Authority is eligible to authorize. So any educational institution that's a public institution that has a geographic footprint somewhere around in this community is eligible to authorize.
You approached the formation of the Learn, Live, Lead Academy with a really unique kind of approach to education. Charlie Creamer, tell us about that.
The approach was, first of all, to provide a safe academic environment. That's first and foremost. But to do it in a way that we could bring forward the entrepreneurial concept to all of the students. I mean, there is an expectation with all of our students that they can achieve what they want to achieve, and if they want to open up a business at a very, very young age and be successful, that's the environment that we really focused on.
Paula, I know you feel really strongly about this. I mean, this baby's your brainchild, isn't it?
It is. And I guess if there's any level of enthusiasm and energy that's to be spent, it's to be spent on making certain that this continues, because we've seen the progress. The individualized learning plans, you and I have talked about that before, that this is not a cookie-cutter approach to learning. Getting the community involved. We've got PNC doing banking inside of our school. I've seen students having a Ziploc bag with 17 cents in it, depositing it into a bank and learning about savings. We've got community partners that are with us and have been involved in coming through the school. We've got entrepreneurs on our wall there. These students are beginning to see what they can be when they grow up, and it's just a unique concept that they can now reach for the stars, and they're beginning to do that and believe that, and that's what the real tragedy here is not allowing that to continue when you start setting those kinds of expectations for students and they start rising to the level of expectation, and then you yank the rug out from under them. That would be the real tragedy, and so that's why we're fighting so hard to make certain we find another authorizer.
You've told me that your students have learned an awful lot in their first year, and tests indicate that?
Absolutely. We have one of the best curriculum consultants around, Dr. Freya Rivers. She has been in doing this work for over 40 years, and she has taken the test that we were supposed to have done in September. We did testing. We did MEEP testing, okay? We did MEEP testing when we were supposed to do MEEP testing. We did study island testing. Our students didn't even know how to use a computer to do NWA testing, which is computer-based testing. They didn't even know how to use a computer to do that.
NWA?
NWA. That's what Bay Mills requires. It's a wonderful national standard for tests. We do that. We do the testing. We just did it later than what was required because we had so many internal issues with students not even knowing how to go on to do that kind of testing. And it is a point-in-time test. So as of May 9th, it would tell you where you are. The testing that we did shows progress every single day, you know, where you need to be, where you have the gaps or the areas that you need to work on. And so we've done testing. We've done MEEP testing. We've done Study Island testing. And we've done the testing that Bay Mills requires as well. And that's why we can say with a tremendous sense of certainty that our students have progressed more than 67% of them one grade level since September. For a school that is 100% free and reduced lunch, 99% African-American, 100% free and reduced lunch, 99% African-American, they've advanced 67% already one grade level from where they started.
I spoke with Dan Quisenberry yesterday, the executive director of the Michigan Association of Public School Academies, MAPSA, and he told me that generally, once you've had a contract terminated like this, that it, quote, very difficult, unquote, to line up a new authorizing body. You're prepared to have to work pretty hard to get reauthorized?
It's very difficult to start a school, too, in 60 days and charter a school, a brand new school, and not go with a national management company. Everything that we've done has been very difficult, so we're used to very difficult. And Dan is absolutely correct. It is a challenge, but we are prepared to meet that challenge, and we think we have a story to tell here.
How do you intend to persuade them, though? You'll bring up the testing, the 67% increase. I mean, you're going to throw everything at the wall after having a contract terminated to try to relaunch here, right?
Well yes. And I don't know if Mr. Charlie Creamer wants to respond to that as well. Excuse me. But to persuade them is to tell the story about what's happened. We've made mistakes. I mean, we were a startup business, if you want to look at it from a small business standpoint or from an entrepreneurial standpoint. We made mistakes in the beginning in terms of not meeting the timelines or the requirements that were listed in our contract. We admit that. But from the time that we realized what we needed to do It took us less than a month to get everything compliant. And from that time forward, there have been no mistakes.
Do you know how often a Michigan charter school has had its contract revoked and then successfully been reauthorized?
I don't know the numbers on that, but I will tell you that one thing that's unique about us is that we were not a nationally managed school. We did not go with like the National Heritage Foundation or Leona Group or the Edison Project. There are companies who manage charter schools for profit, which is fine. They take 15%, 10% of every single dollar. So those companies are major companies that come in and manage schools. We were too small for those types of companies. They weren't interested in us. And so that is a different, when you start talking about the mistakes that we've made or how many other schools may have started out and had some similar issues, that's not apples and oranges comparison. Because if you're, you know, if you've got 83 charter schools throughout the country, like Jason Hyde's a guy, I think he's got 100 and plus schools in National Heritage throughout the country, it's a system. You know, it's a business. We were a community group of people coming together for a community school to manage a community school. And so we did not get out the gate as soon as we would have liked to or had we gone with a national charter or management company.
How many students are enrolled at L3?
We have 78.
Spanning grades what?
K through 6.
78 students. Will you have to cease operations even temporarily while this unfolds, or you're confident you can take this, resolve this over the summer and relaunch?
Mark, this will in no way impact the remainder of the academic year. So that will give us an opportunity to then spend the summer months finalizing a relationship with an authorizer.
Are you seeking help from anybody on this reauthorization project? I mean, is there anybody that you haven't worked with already that you're working with to try to get the school reauthorized?
I'm not sure what I understand the question. They haven't worked with already.
Just given the circumstances you're in, having had a contract terminated, are you reaching out to anybody else to try to help you through this process?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Nope. Not the process of the revocation of the contract, but the process of trying to find another authorizer. Is that what you're referring to? Then yes, absolutely. I mean, the board's been actively engaged. We've all been actively engaged in trying to find another authorizer. But we haven't. No, the board has an attorney to help through this process. Is that what you're referring to?
Okay. That's kind of what I meant. How are you explaining this to families and students?
We're available. We're the same way that we're explaining it, and we're very transparent with everything. We have letters that went out. We've got meetings that we're going to be scheduling. We've talked to the staff, talked to students. I was at the school this morning. So we're being very transparent. There's nothing to hide here. Again, we're very proud of what we've done. The fact that we did not do it within the time frame that was required, that's really what this amounts to. I mean, our school is, our parent survey, 53% response to our parent survey, 100% of those responding felt the school was safe and a great learning environment. 100%.
Okay.
So again, we've done what we're supposed to. We just didn't do it within the time frames initially that we were supposed to.
Paula Cunningham is founder of the Learn, Live, Lead Academy and Capital National Bank CEO. Charlie Creamer is an L3 board vice chair. Many thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Good luck.
To the ball game, take me out with the crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack, I don't care if I never get back, let me root, root, root for the Tigers, if they don't win it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Take me out to the ball game. It's the mighty Uke Day Trio here on Current State on WKAR. It's the third annual Mighty Uke Day this weekend, with many festivities taking place in Lansing's Old Town. And the Mighty Uke Day Trio is going to play for us again here. They are Chris Hamilton on the ukulele. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Andy Wilson has been a multi-instrumentalist here, harmonica and a horn. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
And pocket trumpet, that's what that is.
Right.
And the mighty Uke Day organizer, Ben Hassinger, is also on the ukulele.
Hi.
Welcome, Ben.
Thank you, Mark.
Citizen of the world, Ben Hassinger. tell us about the... You sing along a lot. Do you do instrumental stuff as well, or are you just...
Myself, I usually play and sing. I know Andy does some chord melody on the ukulele.
I do.
And Chris?
Yeah, I do kind of a variety of things on uke too. I do some, you know, kind of playing sing-along, strumming stuff. But I do a little bit of kind of classical stuff too, some chord melody stuff. I, you know, do a lot of instruments too. So the uke is one of my favorite instruments.
And the ukulele is actually pronounced ukulele?
Ukulele. Yeah, in Hawaii it's actually ukulele.
Ukulele.
Ukulele, but I kind of split the difference and say ukulele.
What's its history? Do you know?
Yeah. It was introduced by the Portuguese in the mid-1800s, and the name ukulele means jumping flea in Hawaiian. And the natives saw how fast the players played, and they thought their fingers were like fleas jumping up and down on the fretboard. So it grew in popularity in Hawaii in somewhere around 1915 at the San Francisco Exhibition. They had a big, huge Hawaii pavilion, and they had a lot of ukuleles and hula dancers there, and that's when the ukulele started to take the mainland by storm.
Andy, do you play as well?
I do.
Okay,
yeah.
So there's three of you playing at a time on occasion, is that it?
On occasion, yeah.
Tell us about, there was a horn that you played earlier. Apparently it's called a pocket trumpet. I had never laid eyes on one of these before.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That's a pocket trumpet.
This is the smallest horn you have ever seen in your life.
And the surprising thing about it is that it's actually the same length as a trumpet. They just bend the tubing around and circle it around more than once around so that the whole size of the thing is squished down. So the length of that tube is just as long as any trumpet you find.
The length of the tube is as long.
Tube. It's just got more turns and twists that compact the thing down. The only thing really different about it from a trumpet is the size of the bell, which is smaller.
Is the uke more fun to play than other stringed? Does it rank? You guys play.
Without a doubt.
You guys play several stringed
right.
instruments. You're probably
right.
all guitar
sure.
players
yep.
and
yeah.
Mandolin yep. players and stuff like that. Chris,
yeah.
I know you play a bunch of stringed instruments. How high does the ukulele rate on the fun scale?
It's off the scale.
Yeah, off the charts. Yeah.
The thing about the ukulele to me is I got hooked on it in 2009 when I was in Hawaii, and I went to an ukulele festival, just stumbled on it. And there was probably 3,000 people there, and everybody was just having a great time. And I said, wow, this is a great instrument. So we got a group started in Lansing that year called the Lansing Area Ukulele Group, which meets once a month at Sir Pizza in Old Town. And we usually get 50, 60 people together strumming and singing and having a great time. And what I love about the ukulele, and you guys will probably agree with me on this, is it's a real communal instrument. It's pretty rare you just see one person sitting in a corner playing an ukulele. It's usually a group of people singing together, having a good time.
Warren Buffett has been known to play solo.
Yeah.
He goes solo on
yeah.
his uke every now and then. And I'm told Governor Granholm strums a ukulele.
That would be great.
Okay.
I got Virgil Bonero to play a couple chords on one, waiting for an interview one day.
Is it easier to play? Now, it has this reputation as being kind of the people's instrument.
Right.
You know,
I
mean, it's this big communal kind of thing. Is it easier to play?
Yeah, I teach, you know, four or five different instruments. And I think the really cool thing about ukuleles is that you can really kind of pick it up. And within 5 minutes, just about anybody can play something. But the part that I really like is that it has that ease of getting into. But at the same time, you can take it as far as you want to go. I mean, you can do jazz chords, you can do chord melody, you can do really, you know, as complicated of music as you'd want to, you know, if you want to take it that far. But at the same time, if you just want to learn two chords, you know, and sing along with everybody, you know, you can get up and running and do that in just a couple minutes. So.
For Christmas, I got the George Harrison movie, Martin Scorsese's George Harrison mm-hmm. movie.
Sure.
I don't know if you guys have seen that or not. It's really fantastic chronicle of George Harrison's life. And Harrison became this huge disciple of the ukulele.
Oh, yeah.
To the point where he'd visit Tom Petty or Jeff Lynne or some of of his friends in the Mighty Wilburys, and he'd just leave ukuleles at their house.
Sure.
He was so wedded to it.
He had quite a collection at his home, so whenever people came over to visit, they'd all end up playing ukulele.
Yeah.
And McCartney now, whenever he does performances, he often will play something as a tribute.
That's right.
To George on the ukulele.
That's right. How long have you three been together?
Well, let's see. What time do we get here? 8:30. We've kind of played
group.
Together on and off. Right, yeah. We're a super group.
You're
That's
a very
it.
Spontaneously formed super group. What is happening this weekend?
Oh, my goodness. So many things. This is our third annual Mighty Uke Day Ukulele Festival. And it's called Mighty Uke Day, but it's actually going on for a day and a half because we expanded it this year. Tomorrow, which God, it's tomorrow already, I can't believe it. We're going to have a big group strum and some individual performances at Sir Pizza at noon. And then that evening, we have an act coming in from Minneapolis, and her name is Danielle Ate the Sandwich, which I don't think is her given name for some reason. But she's great. She's one of these internet ukulele sensations, and she's had millions of views on YouTube, and she's a lot of fun. And opening for her, actually, Andy and his wife are performing together as the Springtails. And we also have Susan Picking from Grand Rapids coming in. So that's Friday. And then Saturday, everything goes ukulele crazy. We start at 10 in the morning with a big group strum at Sir Pizza. Chris is doing a workshop at 11, I think.
Yeah, yep.
And he's doing a Beatles song workshop. So we threw a Beatles song in there for you guys. We've got multiple workshops going on. We have a children's tent. We have a free children's workshop to get them to play the ukulele. We've got just music going on all day, and it ends with one of the most amazing ukulele players you'll ever see, and his name is James Hill from Canada, and he's one of the top two or three ukulele players in the world, and he's coming to Old Town on Saturday.
Ook fever.
That's
it. And in Lansing's Old Town, why don't you guys make it back to your back to your seats, and you can play us out. Once again, it's been the Mighty Uke Day Trio. Chris Hamilton, Andy Wilson, and Mighty Uke Day organizer Ben Hassinger here ready to take us to the
All
end
right.
of the program. Go for it, guys.
Song about our favorite place in East in Lansing called Old Town. And go to www.mightyukeday.com. 1, 2. When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go to Old Town. When you got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. In Old Town, just listen to the strumming of the mighty ukulele. Linger at Sir Pizza with the people singing gaily. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, and go to Old Town. Things will be great when you're in Old Town. No finer place for sure. Old Town, everything's waiting for you. Old Town. Old Town. Don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are many stories.
The Mighty Uke Day Trio here on Current State. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll discuss the growing conflict of sexual assault in the U.S. military. Also, we'll look at how Michigan State University is working to strengthen and develop ties with Cuba. That is Friday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR.
Forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, and go to Old Town. Where all the lights are bright, Old Town, waiting for you tonight, Old Town, you're gonna be all right now, Old Town, Old Town.
Andy!
Old Town. Find somebody kind to help and understand you. Someone who is just like you.